Yes, the whimsical warble of a magpie is a pretty distinctive part of the Australian landscape and soundscape. The cheerful carolling always reminds me of camping and frosty winter mornings. Apart from their song, magpies are known for two other things. Their rather enthusiastic territorialism, swooping any they deem a threat, and for their great intelligence. Dr. Lizzie Speechley is a behavioural ecologist at the University of Western Australia and has just published a new study on the smarts of these beady-eyed, swoopy boys. Lizzie, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks, Andy. Thanks for having me.
Intelligence, as they say, is relative. So I'm curious to know how you decided to define intelligence for this study. Presumably, the intelligence of humans would be different to the intelligence of animals.
Absolutely. We always call it cognition. And cognition is essentially their information processing. So their ability to take in information from their environment, to process that in their brains, and then decide whether or not to act on it.
We know humans can store the memory and identity of hundreds of different faces of all the people we know, almost like a Facebook or LinkedIn in our brains. And we know magpies can do something similar to up to 100 different human faces. So what's going on in our brains versus the avian brain that's either similar or different when it comes to this kind of cognition?
Absolutely. So just on the recognition, we actually did an experiment a few years ago where we wondered if they could recognize us by our voices alone rather than just the visual cue. And we played back our voices versus the voices of people they hadn't heard, and they actually had a more of a response to our voices. So they can recognize vocal cues as well. In terms of what's happening in their brain, I have no idea. We focus really on how they're actually using those cognitive skills rather than just looking at the brain alone. So you can have a really big brain, but can you use the abilities that are in that brain? So that's really what we look at with the magpies.
There was that famous study done a number of years ago using crows, and the researchers wore clown masks, and the memory of a crow to remember that either the clown man was evil and didn't give them food or was benevolent and did give them food is quite extraordinary. And you can see the practical applied use of this kind of intelligence or cognition in everyday life for our avian friends. I mean, this is about threat perception, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I'm familiar with that study. It's a really interesting study and one that would be really interesting to do with the magpies. But yeah, it's very important. And obviously they are known for swooping. But we do know that they recognize threats and swoop accordingly. So for example, if a child has come running through the territory very loud, just playing, they perceive that as a threat and therefore they're more likely to swoop children in the future. Same with dogs and things like that.
Tell me about these wooden puzzle boards that you used, you created and used in the testing of the cognition amongst magpie fledglings.
Yeah, absolutely. So we call them an associative learning test because basically what they're doing is testing the magpie's ability to associate a colour cue with a food reward. And essentially the puzzle board is just a wooden block with some holes in it. And those holes are covered with little plastic lids that are painted different colours. And it's important to point out that we try and do different shades of a colour. So, for example, a light pink versus a dark pink, because it is possible, given that they are wild birds, that they have an aversion to certain colours. Like we know in nature, red generally means poisonous. So we do the two different shades. And we will hide the food reward under one of those specific coloured lids. So, for example, if I always hide it under the dark pink, we want to see if they remember that it's always hidden under that dark pink well.
And how well do they remember these patterns?
Yes. So what we do with the fledglings is we actually test them at three time points during their first year of life. So we test them at 100 days after leaving the nest, 200 days and 300 days. And we found that overall they do improve over time, which is nice to see. It shows that they're learning over that first year of life. But overall, what we found was the ones that are raised in these larger social groups tended to make that association with the colour cue faster than those that were in smaller groups.
Now, this is the real crux here, isn't it? Because this study essentially points to the fact that magpie intelligence levels are not necessarily nature, but nurture because of their community or group learning in larger family groups.
Yes, absolutely. And the whole point of this study really came from one of my supervisors. He had a really impactful paper in Nature where he found that adult magpies that are in larger groups are smarter. So what we wanted to do was take that back to fledglings and figure out how much of it is the social group and how much of it is simply just that they're genetically smarter. And what we found in this study was it really seems to have very little evidence that it is genetic and that if you have a smart mum, you're going to be a smart baby magpie. It seems to be really something to do with that social group that they're raised in that is driving their intelligence or cognition.
It's so fascinating, I think, you know, when you look at study of intelligence in particularly mammals, I'm thinking whales and chimps, primates, that sort of thing, that live in groups. This inevitably becomes a debating point because the social or nurture aspect really makes sense for avian species such as magpies as well. So what aspects of the social environment were most important to the cognitive development for these magpie fledglings?
Yeah, that's a really good point because this theory actually was initially proposed by Charles Darwin. It's been around for a long time. He first made the link between sociality and cognition, and it wasn't formalized until the 1970s in what we call the social intelligence hypothesis. So exactly what you described, that something about those social groups is driving intelligence. The rest of my PhD thesis was really devoted to what you just asked, so what it is about that social group that is so important for them. And what we did to investigate that was we looked at lots of different social behaviours. We looked at how much they play, their aggression, their vocalisations, and even just how physically close they are to one another. And we were trying to find what was really linking with the intelligence. And what we found in the fledglings is it's actually related to aggression and also vocalizations. So the magpies that were receiving a lot of aggression tended to be smarter, which makes sense because if you're in a social group and you're getting attacked, you want to try and figure out a way to not be attacked. And also their vocalizations. So if they're communicating more with one another, that means that they tend to be smarter, which again makes sense because they're learning vocal cues.
Is this inadvertently a biological imperative for the use of bullying in social groups? I mean, it's obviously not a very popular thought these days because I think we try in human circles to be inclusive and supportive. But it sounds like in magpies, there is perhaps a biological reason. You use the word aggression. But, I mean, bullying could also be used, it sounds.
Absolutely. That's sort of how I wrapped my head around it when I first saw the results, because it is actually the ones that are the most aggressive in their group are actually performing the worst. And that makes sense with that notion of, you know, maybe bullies bully because they're not that smart. It makes sense because our WA magpies are particularly special. They live in social groups year-round, which I don't believe happens in any of the other states. So they're in these cooperative social groups where they work together to defend the territory, to raise the young, all sorts of things. So if you're being aggressive to your group members, it isn't particularly smart or beneficial to you to do that.
If you just joined me, behavioural ecologist Dr. Lizzie Speech leads with me. We're discussing the cognitive development of magpies. So let's really get into the conflict element of this. We're going to start an East Coast, West Coast rap battle here because you're studying Western magpies and essentially what you've found is that there are some differences in cognition between the Eastern magpies. Who's smarter? Let's start there.
I'd love to say, but I haven't tested it, so I'm going to be cautious on what I say there.
Oh, don't sit on the fence. Come on.
But Basically, it is in the works. I believe my supervisor is actually going to look at comparing cognition between Eastern and Western magpies. But what I do know is that I believe in the eastern states, the magpies are generally in pairs. They do come together in sort of temporary flocks during breeding, whereas in WA, they're obviously in these cooperative groups year-round, and they're in a set group for the duration of their life, which can be up to and over 25 years. So if we're linking it to social environment, we would expect that perhaps the Western ones are smarter because they have a more demanding sort of social life.
That's so fascinating. And so what do we know about how smart they are, magpies are generally in relation to other species of bird? We know there's been some interesting work and reporting done on Australian songbirds more generally being overly intelligent, but how do we compare them to other species of bird, both in Australia and overseas?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm obviously not overly familiar with comparing between species. My research is very much focused at looking within a species, which individuals show better cognitive performance. But it is actually a really tricky question. I guess in the past, what they've done is taken neuroanatomical measures, so things like brain size, and tried to compare differences in brain size between species, and that's how they've compared intelligence. If we're going to compare intelligence similar to how we do by giving them some sort of cognitive test, there's a lot of issues with that because obviously different animals have different dexterity and ability to interact with that test. They have different colour perception, and just generally what's smart for a magpie might not necessarily be smart for another species. So it's actually quite a tricky question to answer. So I'm not 100% sure.
I know that humans are innately narcissistic, and in doing your work, it must be so difficult to avoid the anthropomorphization of magpies and the intelligence or personality that you might perceive. When you're watching and interacting with them, can you avoid making these personality distinctions? You're obviously comparing between family groups as well, so you're seeing a ready-made control because you're watching more than one magpie interact. Do you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I think so. And it is tricky because especially when we relay our research, everyone loves to make that sort of connection with themselves. And again, like what we were saying, that whole bullying discussion, we relate it to our own experience growing up. But in terms of interacting with the magpie and just differences in personality, is that sort of what you were getting at with that question?
Yeah, absolutely. Because usually when you're watching an animal, when it's alone, you're comparing it to yourself and the way that it interacts with its environment or uses tools or, you know, the cognition that goes on underneath. But when you're seeing a bird interact with another bird, you've got something to compare it to, and therefore you could almost automatically make personality distinctions, I'm assuming.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, you kind of do see it, that they do have very distinct personalities, like the ones that are aggressive are always aggressive and vice versa. We obviously try and be impartial as much as we can, but it is hard not to relate that to yourself.
Tell me about the warbling, because it is such an idiosyncratic part of the Australian landscape, and everyone in Australia would have heard the magpie warble at one time or another. What is its purpose amongst the group? Tell me about the range in which they're able to communicate.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a beautiful sound, and they have an incredible vocal range. One of my fellow PhD student Sarah Walsh was looking specifically at their vocal range. So she's more of an expert in that than I am. But in this study, we looked specifically, we call it the chorus, but the warble. And it's actually used in a whole suite of different contexts. Sometimes it's used simply to say a lot, hello. Sometimes it's used for a social bonding call. But then on the other end of the spectrum, it can be used when they're fighting, when they're defending their territory. Or often you'll just see the younger ones off on their own singing to themselves, and that's just them practicing their song for the future.
It does make me think about a musical theatre because, yeah, you get actors dance fighting and sing fighting and then, you know, having a soliloquy exactly the same as magpies do. There I go again, anthropomorphising magpies. When you look to the future and the way in which we're starting to understand avian intelligence or cognition, where's the really exciting push, the next really exciting push in terms of what researchers like yourself are dying to know?
Yeah, it is a really, really interesting facet of evolution. And I suppose particularly for me, really, I would like to understand this sort of aggression link a little bit more as to why is it aggression. The other thing that we find really interesting is we're obviously using quite a simplified test, you know, can you associate a colour with a food reward and how does that link with your sociality? What we would like to do is use some tests that are more specifically social. So they have a real social cognition component, and they can be things like social learning. So do you learn from others in your group? Or there's also something called third party recognition. So for example, if I'm standing along the sidelines and I watch a fight, do I recognize who that winner is and remember, okay, don't pick a fight with that winner in the future? So there's definitely steps forward in terms of us understanding this in a bit more detail.
Fascinating research. Great to talk to you. Dr. Lizzie Speechley has been my guest. She's a behavioral ecologist at the University of Western Australia. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to a podcast of The Drawing Room with me, Andy Park. For more great conversations, search for The Drawing Room on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.